afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, August 16th, 2022. Howdy do, Dave.
Hey, top of the day to you, Melody. Hello, listeners. And happy National Roller Coaster Day.
Mm.
I know, I have to say,
how
apropos, given the volatility in the financial markets these days. But look, more importantly, on this day in 1892, well, salmon fishing near the Klondike River in Canada's Yukon Territory, good old George Carmack spotted nuggets of gold in a creek bed, sparking the last great gold rush in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at least until the next one that's coming soon.
Absolutely. Well, we've kind of been in a gold rush, you know, off and on throughout the year since we were able to own it again. But the big one, the biggie is coming. And today, you wouldn't know it, with a little bit of pressure on gold today, 1777 in the New York spot price after market. You have silver down 12 cents at $20.25, but both platinum and palladium were stronger today, platinum by a dollar and palladium by five. And it's 945 platinum, palladium 2,232. The USDX today, of course, was stronger, 0.03 at 106.52. Crude oil was down another $3 at 86.40. Paper markets today, let's see. The Dow was up. I was reading something about Bed Bath & Beyond, soared 70%. Okay. I can't imagine. Have you been to one of their stores lately? But anyway, the Dow Jones was up 240 points at 34,151. And, of course, it was mainly buoyed by Walmart and Home Depot. So I guess they came out with some good numbers. S&P was up 8 points, 43.05. NASDAQ was negative by 25, 13,102. Asian markets, Shanghai was stronger. Europe, again, another day with positive gains. But again, I don't think anyone, well, two of them barely made it over a quarter of a percent. 10-year yield was higher today, 2.81, up 0.022. And natural gas was natural gas was higher by 7%, back up over 9.367 for natural gas. So we haven't seen it that high in a long time. And so not sure what that one is about on the natural gas side when you have other oils all down negative. So we'll see what's going on. And let's see, where are we going to start out today, Dave? What do we want to talk about first? Why don't we go ahead and talk about, Social Security? It's kind of a slow news day. It really is. There's a lot going on, but yet it's still a slow news day. There wasn't anything really exciting out there in the news except, you know, the elections continue to go on and so forth. So we're going to talk about the Social Security benefits could rise by near record in 2023. And I think we did talk briefly about this, about the Senior Citizens League annual estimate for Social Security adjustment predicts that the monthly benefits could rise to a near record of almost 10% next year. And, Social Security does adjust for inflation, although it never ever keeps up with the true rate of inflation, but they do try and they come out and tell you that they're adjusting for inflation. I think 10% is pretty big, but usually you don't get that much. The COLA is based on inflation readings by the Labor Department in July, August, and September. And you know, some people think that inflation peaked, but I don't think it has. But you never know with what they'll come out. I mean, we did see the consumer price index dip to 8.5%, but I can't imagine that it's going to drop any much more for this month or September. So they'll make this announcement in October. First payment adjusted will be in January of 2023. And you know what's funny, though, Dave, is now you're beginning to hear more and more comments about addressing the Social Security issues. So, read the small print. They giveth and they taketh away. Right, Dave?
Well, in general, yeah. I wonder if this one idea about increasing the threshold, which is now around $147,000, you're taxed on Social Security up until roughly $147,000 of income, and then you know it's gone for the rest of the year. Some members of the House and Senate are talking about eliminating, or actually, I guess, creating a donut hole. Where once you hit $400,000 in income, you'll be Social Security would kick in again, and some are saying that other things being equal, that could shore up the Social Security Trust Fund for another few decades, but I don't. See anything that significant happening anytime soon. So,
not during an election year anyway, but there's been grumblings about it. And my thing is, why don't they address Medicaid? That's what they should be addressing. You know, that's, you know, but they won't touch that. They never touch Medicaid, as far as I know. If they do, it isn't by much. That one keeps growing and growing with people not putting anything into it. I mean, all the programs were meant to go belly up, and if they keep their picking fingers out of it and quit using it, I don't know, Dave. It's just you know, anytime they get involved in trying to fix things, it always makes it worse. So. Anyway, and you know, I grew up knowing, hey, Social Security is not going to be there for you, so you better do something. You better prepare for your own retirement. We've heard that for how many years? So younger people should be preparing and not be dependent on Social Security, you know, and, you know, they need to start doing things, but it's difficult in the world that we live. But anyway,
yeah, you know, some are saying this even a 9.6% increase would probably not be enough for many seniors to keep up with the cost of living, particularly in this high inflation environment. This one study the League of Senior Citizens found that 37% of Social Security participants received low-income assistance last year, presumably food stamps, medical assistance, and perhaps even cash assistance. The 2017 study by the Social Security Administration found that about 1 in 5 Americans aged 65 and over received at least 90% of their total incomes from Social Security. Talk about living paycheck to paycheck, Melody. Your words resonate.
Yes, truly. You know, the next thing we're going to talk about, I don't know. And this, because I guess it was signed today, the quote-unquote Inflation Reduction Act, which is really kind of funny. Companies, we often talk about buybacks in this country, and I don't agree with them, you know, and that's what keeps a lot of these shares up is these companies are buying back their own shares and stock buybacks. Well, now they're going to face a new 1% excise tax on purchases of their own shares. My question is, they probably make a whole lot more than 1%. So, I mean, this is really, to me, it's supposed to be like a penalty on these buybacks that they've used for a long time to return cash to investors and to bolster their stock price. Now, this is supposed to take place next year. We've seen buybacks and how they ballooned in recent years. I think this year they're forecasted to reach $1 trillion. And as we've seen so many of these companies that have swelled with cash from their profits. And you have pensions and retirement funds, investors like the buybacks. But then again, those who dislike them calling the practice paper manipulation, and it does enrich the senior executives and the big shareholders. And again, you got to remember, anything that these companies are going to be taxed on or whatever, it's just going to be passed through. And I don't understand why people can't grasp that. They're just going to raise prices and do what they can, or they'll make, if they're going to be taxed 1%, they'll still be making, you know, 10%, 15%, 20%. What's 1%? So again, anything to make it a little bit more difficult. Well, to me, if you're going to tax something, 1% is not enough in order to stop the buybacks. To me, it's just more lip service and showing, and it's just, you know, not enough. And how much more are we going to continue? As soon as government needs money, hey, we're just going to raise taxes and so forth. So we'll have to see if this actually does anything, Dave.
Yeah, they're talking about raising $74 billion over 10 years from.
Well, that's
this.
A whole lot in 10 years.
$7.4 billion a year.
Wow. When we're $30 trillion in debt.
Pennies on the dollar. But there are some experts out there that are skeptical that this tax will work as intended. They note that businesses have other methods for rewarding shareholders, namely dividends. But how this all plays out could be significant, particularly for these big companies, their employees and their shareholders. Now, major companies in the S&P 500 bought a record amount of their own stock last year, $882 billion. Buybacks reached $984 in the 12 months through the end of the first quarter. That's a record as well. You know, a lot of these are big tech companies, Apple, Facebook parent Meta, Google parent Alphabet. And the banks, the big banks, too big to fail, love them too. But so do most other major multinationals. And, you know, this is, I mean, again, it's, I think, a well-intentioned law. I suspect that the 1% is largely a function of that's all that Manchin and Sinema were willing to support. I don't recall having seen that explicitly, but based on you know, their major roles in how this. This new law has come out of Congress. I suspect that has, you know, a big impact, Melody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all we do is raise tax. I'm not a fan of when the Trump administration had the tax cuts. It's like, no, it just, you know, it's just a dog and pony show. It doesn't really help the people who really need it. And then it's the same thing for everything else. It's we're the ones. It all gets funneled down. You know, they might be, you know, they're going to get other subsidies in order to make up the 1% that they'd be paying. And I mean, it's like, no, nobody's going to do anything to offset or to interrupt anything that they get you know, from lobbyists and everything else. And I know you're going to talk, I don't know if we're going to talk about, you're going to talk about, with the one senator that you just mentioned, she just got $1 million. You know, and it's just, the story just goes on and on and on. And yet who pays for it? The taxpayer. And things get worse for us. And it's really disgusting. And how do we change it? Well, they're not going to change anything that really needs to be changed, like campaign financing and donations and term limits. And those have real impacts, you know, on things. And are they going to do it? Heck no. How about cutting back their retirement? How about cutting back their, you know, benefits and so forth to where they get what we get? No, not going to do that. Uh-uh. So anyway, but... So anyway, I think a lot of this with the higher food costs for higher prices for food and clothing and everything else should bring down a little bit of consumer spending. And although you wouldn't know it as yet, but, you know, I think we're going to see much higher credit card debt. These buybacks can increase companies' earnings per share because there's fewer shares held by shareholders. And so, yeah, I don't agree with buybacks. Why don't they just eliminate them?
Yeah,
that's beneficial.
It used to be forbidden decades ago. They weren't allowed.
And then
things changed. The whole ballgame changed. And, you know, with this new tax schedule to go into effect on the first of the new year, I think the rest of this year we could see a ramp up in these buybacks because they have a deadline now for buying back their stock tax free.
Well, we'll see if it does. And if it doesn't, then we'll know that it's just something that they're just laughing about and joking about. And, you know, it's the same way when these, you know, big corporation CEOs and stuff, well, I think they should raise taxes on us. And, well, I pay more. And that's just a bunch of it's just amazing. But anyway,
Colonel Potter, he used to call it horse hockey.
Yes. Yes. There you go. You know, U.S. isn't in a recession, even though we've had two negative GDP growth in two quarters. They can't say that. They're not even talking about that anymore. China's having issues, too. And I've seen where their housing market is just really kind of coming undone. They're looking for looks like they could be heading for a recession. I don't know what their guidelines are, but looks like they're heading for one, too. We're out of time already in this first break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for the weekly newsletter and, of course, Dave's Friday blog. That comes out no cost to you. And we got some... You know, I did a price comparison online today, and for a customer for some half ounce American Gold Eagles, and I just couldn't believe what people are charging for those online. The big dealers, I mean, they're charging 4% more than what I'm charging. That's huge.
That's a lot.
4%. And that's if you buy a lot of them. So for the little guy who just wants to buy one or two, he's probably getting whacked 20%. Or maybe 6% or 7% more than what I would charge. So it's a lot. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. And this is an interesting article, and I've been having a lot of phone calls and questions about what's coming in later this year with this idea that Biden signed an executive order in order to implement a crypto digital currency effective December. I don't believe it's true. I don't believe it's true. I know he signed into an executive order to do research.
Yes.
And I think there was a deadline for that. And I don't know if that is the December deadline, but I'm not sure it's quote unquote to be implemented. However, this next article sort of supports that we might face something like that sooner than later, I believe. And so there's a big question swirling around the Fed that isn't about inflation in the labor market. It's about which institutions can notch a coveted account with the Fed. The Fed just finalized its attempt to clarify how regional banks should evaluate access to these accounts. A process some critics have tried it as inconsistent and non-transparent. New companies, now which do include the crypto sector, are pushing for these accounts long reserved just for the traditional banks. There's a debate over whether granting more access will prove perilous to the financial system, which I think it would. But hey, that's just me. Now, this master account is really a good thing, is really a hot thing to have. It allows one's firm to store funds with the Fed. So how does that work, Dave? It's like a savings account with the Fed. You get to store your money there. But is that it?
That's part of it, yeah.
Reserves can be stored there. But also... it allows them to transfer money with one another. That's the one big thing about blockchain and cryptos is how difficult it is to access them, both when you buy and when you sell. Without this access to the Fed, companies have to go through banks. that do have access, but that costs money. they charge fees for that, and this is, you know, those fees add up over the course of a year, particularly for, you know, essentially the larger the company, the larger, well, the more fee they'll pay over the course of any given year. So that's, I think, the crux of it, that, you know, one thing leads to the other, basically. But the good news is the Fed can deny access to anyone that it deems is too risky. And
which they would never do.
Well, you know, well, hopefully, hopefully they're not going to, well, hopefully they're going to see these crypto companies as just that, too risky to bring into the system. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, as you mentioned with the talk for the last few years about creating a new digital currency or a central bank currency, and this raises all kinds of questions and issues, and you know, I'd love to see the provision added to this new rule that basically says cryptocurrency companies as a group are too risky and will not be allowed to open an account at the Fed.
I would think to some degree it competes against the dollar. And it would eliminate the usage of, I mean, it opens the door to where you wouldn't be using the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency anymore, because now you have these other options through the Fed, and who knows who owns these cryptocurrency companies, which is probably a lot of governments, other, you know, we know a lot of these in China. You know, so, and how would it be set aside? I mean, it certainly is not going to be transparent. We would have probably no idea, or the breakdown on where the crypto's coming in and going out. I mean, I'm sure they probably have that all worked out and so forth, but I can't imagine that we would be privy to that. Or if the cryptos are supposed to be so private, how can they track whose money it is? Right?
Well, they can't.
They can't. So the Federal Reserve would be holding money on people they don't even know. Right?
Hypothetically. But I mean, you know, just in terms of borrowing money overnight, for example, stashing their cash there. I mean, the Fed doesn't know who bank customers are as well, but they know who the banks are. They know their direct customers, the banks and other financial institutions. This, I think, just gets the Fed in bed with a player that is known to be questionable, shall we say. I mean, certainly not everyone who invests, and there are a lot of small investors in Bitcoin and the other firms, but these firms still have a lot of money in them, even though they've lost a lot of market cap this year. It's a slippery slope if they go down this road.
So is it that the Federal Reserve wants more control?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. We need to learn more about it. It's another reason why there needs to be more regulation of the cryptocurrency companies, and you know, whether it's, you know, the Fed, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or more likely the SEC. And
we know how well they do.
None of it's ideal, but they need to do something.
Well, you know, it's just you know, it's, you know, I don't know, but again, this could also be the beginning of to where, you know, the government could, this could be all part of the, you know, changeover from, you know, the Federal Reserve to digital currency and so forth. You know, it could be part of the plan, or they have to institute this in order to go to the next step or something like that. I don't know, but
yeah,
it certainly does open a lot of doors. And my theory has always been, before that's really going to be acceptable and so forth, we're going to have, you know, they will be defaulting on the debt or whatever. We're going to have some sort of a market correction, whatever you want to call it, the reset or whatever you want to call it. There will be calamity in the financial markets before anything new will be introduced, because that's the only way people will accept something new, is they'll think it's better and it'll be promised to them that it's better, and they'll scoop it up in a moment. And without thinking anything through. But anyway, let's go ahead and move on. We have a couple things just on Russia as far as the grain shipments. They're moving, and that's a good thing. Where a lot of folks, a lot of countries in Asia and Africa and Middle East rely on this subsidized wheat for survival and bread, the wheat, barley, corn, sunflower. I'm pretty sure we're probably dependent on it too, because we import a whole lot of stuff. But I don't think we're on the brink of starvation like some of these other countries might be. So, and the two deals that the UN and the Turkey brokered last month to unblock food supplies depend on each other. And so, I mean, that is a good thing. But so we'll just have to see about the fertilizer. I don't think they're looking to face sanctions. And we certainly know the problem we have over here with lack of fertilizer, Dave.
Yeah, what I found interesting in this story is agriculture accounts for about 4% of Russia GDP. It's according to the World Bank. But there, this Russian economist, Sergei Alekseyenko, says what's more...
Answer your question. Wikipedia. Shankar Shanmugam, credited as S. Shankar or his mononym Shankar, is an Indian filmmaker who predominantly...
Yeah, did your little box pick up your question?
I guess Alexa heard Alekseyenko. Anyway, sorry about that, folks. But employment, 7 to 8% of employment, Russia employment. Farming provides almost 6 million jobs there. So you know why they were certainly engaged in this deal. So anyway, that's all I have to say.
All right. Let's go ahead and talk about the South China Sea, because time is really going by. The commander of the U.S. 7th Fleet said today that he's seen an increase in unsafe aerial intercepts by the Chinese military. Of course, that's in the South China Sea region. And even as early as May, you had a Chinese fighter aircraft that was said to intercept a Royal Australian maritime surveillance plane in the South China Sea region. In a manner that Australia's Defense Department said that it was dangerous to its aircraft and crew. The department said the Chinese aircraft fired chaff that was sucked into the Australian plane's engine. This report increases in the air is obviously concerning. It's not a very forgiving environment if something goes wrong. And I would have to agree with that, Dave. Thomas said in a brief press briefing in Singapore that keeping sea lanes open is the first and foremost mission of the U.S. Navy. And Let's see if there's anything else.
Yeah, he maintains that China's claims over the South China Sea have to be challenged. He said otherwise it becomes the norm. People just accept it, and then all of a sudden China can start making claims like the entire South China Sea is theirs. And it's not. Well, at least not yet.
Well, if it's challenged, then doesn't that equal war?
No. But just... No, it just it's a statement of opinion, fact, whatever you call it. It just what it does is it promotes diplomatic scuffling.
Nicely put.
There we go.
Well, you know, we've been talking about how the housing activity is just dropping unbelievably, and with the rising rates and so forth. And there was some new data that was out this morning, Dave, that points to a multifamily. These bigger housing projects, it's just kind of the opposite of the single family construction. These multifamily units continue to be the area of strength in response to high rental rates and you know, even more demand as less people can afford to buy homes because of the higher rates and, of course, the cost of homes anymore, Dave.
Yeah, I can personally attest to that, Melody. In my own small community of about 4,000, where I sit on the local planning commission, the last two land development plans we looked at call for the construction of over 500 semi-attached townhouses. No single-family developments to speak of whatsoever. And that's largely, I mean, the price points they're taught that the owners are talking about are, I wouldn't necessarily say they're low or affordable housing type, but they're probably on the lower end. They're certainly below the national average of 416,000. I think they're talking about the high twos to the low to mid threes.
Oh, so. Wow. Did they approve it? And
yeah, we recommended approval. Let's put it that way. Our council, the elected folks, are charged with approving or denying.
Wow.
They'll approve.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're already at break time, so we'll have to be coming back here shortly. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of other client business. This final segment, you can reach her at 1-800-375-4188. Now, with the recent, quote, slowdown in inflation, that is having been static from June to July, the Fed's faced with a real dilemma here ahead of a plan next month to double the rate at which it's shrinking its massive $9 trillion balance sheet. The move to speed up quantitative tightening, or QT, we'll call it, is meant to further drain the pandemic-era stimulus from the financial system and increase borrowing rates for particularly longer-dated assets to weaken inflation. But that's taking place at the same time the Fed pushes ahead with interest rate hikes, which is currently, to tame inflation, which is running at more than three times the Fed's 2% target. That's the core, right? If you include all, it's over four times the target. The double tightening, however, makes it harder for the achieve a soft landing where the economy slows but avoids a recession. Now, with some investors believing the economy is already in a recession, speculation has grown that if something has to give, it could be the pace at which QT unfolds. And some bond traders are saying the odds remain long that the Fed would change its plan in the near term. We have Young Yu Ma at BMO Wealth Management believes there's some latitude for the Fed to eventually go on a slow trajectory on QT or even end it earlier than expected. But it's hard to know how the Fed balances things out. Young asks, at what point does the Fed view that financial conditions have tightened enough? In his words, that's nebulous, and you really don't know until after the fact if you've gone too far. The economy contracted over 2.5% in the first half of this year, amplifying an ongoing debate over whether we're in or soon will be in recession, along with two straight quarterly contractions, two reports last week that suggested inflation had likely peaked in July. It took some pressure off the Fed, perhaps, to deliver another big rate hike at its next policy meeting on September 20th and 21st. Traders of futures tied to the Fed funds rate are now pricing in a 60% chance of a 50 basis point hike at the September meeting. That's down from a 68% probability of a 75 basis point hike just 2 weeks ago. Kathy Jones at the Schwab Center for Financial Research says that we really think the Fed slows down sooner rather than later. The data are starting to adjust, and we're seeing a slower economy. I think it's a little too soon for that, but still, her base case for the Fed is to run QT as is, but use that as a lever that could be adjusted, basically in conjunction with its rate hikes and what happens in the economy as a whole. If the rate hikes go fast and furious and they reverse, then they have to stop QT, she said. If the rate hikes slow and level off, then they can continue it for a longer time period and tighten policy through the back door instead of the front. Either way, following the recent tamer CPI reading last month, a number of Fed officials say it's too early to declare victory on the inflation front. Economist Jamie Danhauser at London-based asset manager Ruffer LLP says inflation remains far, far above anything that could be considered price stability. It remains a very long journey back towards acceptable levels of inflation. But she doesn't believe falling inflation numbers will affect the Fed's QT plan. Again, the Fed's balance sheet last week was at just about $8.9 trillion. Its holdings of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities have only marginally declined since June when the Fed started QT, but it should come down over time, although it certainly won't occur in a straight line that they had initially talked about. But here's an interesting thing. Bank reserves held at the Fed have fallen to $3.3 trillion. That's down about $1 trillion from a high of $4.3 in December last year. Analysts say that contraction has been faster than many anticipated. In the Fed's previous tightening process, $1.3 trillion in liquidity was withdrawn over 5 years. The Fed hasn't announced a target size for its balance sheet. Others, like TD Securities, thinks the Fed's ultimate goal will be to reduce the balance sheet to a point where the bank reserves reach about 9% of GDP, which is where they stood prior to the September 2019 liquidity crunch. Down QT would be an option if it creates a shortage of bank reserves that starts to limit bank activities like lending or market making. Anyway, we'll see what happens. In any event, we know the Fed's perpetually behind the curve in controlling inflation and anticipating deflation. Don't know what's going to happen, but it sure will be interesting, and we'll be sure to bring it to you. Food for thought, ladies and gentlemen. Soaring rents. They've been mainly a big city thing last 2 years. Now they're an everywhere problem. Skyrocketing rents with housing prices at historic highs make it hard for people to afford to live. Rent listings in the second quarter this year were 23% higher nationwide compared to the same period in 2019. Median asking rent is now $1,314 a month, more than double the 600 rate in 2005. Now, these asking rents are the price landlords charge new tenants, as opposed to renewal rents, the price you pay when your lease is up and renewed. Those are going up as well, but not as much. And of course, soaring rents contribute to inflation, causing the Fed to raise rates and put the brakes on the economy, putting them closer to the possibility of a recession. Many experts say a recession wouldn't bring much relief to renters in any event. When the economy slows down, rents generally don't fall. But people do lose their jobs, making it harder to pay. One reason rent prices are a bit recession-proof is people are less likely to buy homes when the economy isn't doing well. You know, landlords are passing on their rising costs to renters. Landlords are also capitalizing on the strong demand for housing, especially in places where folks move to because of remote work, especially during the height of the pandemic when virtually the whole country was shut down. Plus, people want more space, and some trade up for more square footage. One of my friends told me over the weekend that he's helping one of his sons move into a new Manhattan, lower Manhattan rental today. Better sit down for this. The cost for his two-bedroom flat in Tribeca, a healthy $5,600 a month, plus utilities, plus parking. Oh, it's crazy. Alas, today, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. In addition to Melody's weekly market recap and Doug Nolan's credit bubble bulletin blog and Wendy Wilson's food for thought, she talks about needle phobia. I have an article about big oil profits. In late June, I wrote in our What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog how crack spreads would see more pressure as the Biden administration does everything in its power to push gas prices lower before November's midterm elections. Crack spreads, as I mentioned, measure the difference between the cost of crude oil and the prices of its refined products, namely gasoline. And are a key contributor but to both profits at oil refineries and also to prices at the pump. Spreads, also known as oil refiners' profits, have soared this year as gasoline demand outstrips supply, not just here but all around the world. While surging profits for the makers of gasoline have opened the industry up to charges of price gouging, industry officials claim they're producing as much gas as they can these days. Well, industry capacity utilization was running at 94% as the summer began. That's the highest since 2018 when it hit 97. At the same time, the Department of Energy report also showed that overall refinery capacity has fallen in the last 2 years. In fact, it's now back to where it was in 2014. And that means that supply would be stifled even if refineries were to be running at 100%. So I wrote, with little chance of bringing new sources of gasoline on time online anytime soon, the administration's best chance to lower prices at the pump in the near term would have to come from leaning on OPEC Plus to drill more oil or on refiners to accept smaller profit margins. Others might say, well, open up more of our country's vast lands to drilling. In any event, I predicted that will become a growing source of agita for investors in oil companies as well as other industries. Well, it seems I was a tad overconfident. Oil giants have made huge profits this year as prices and demand has soared. Saudi Aramco, the world's largest oil company, yesterday reported a 90% increase in second quarter profits over last year, $48.4 billion. Competitors like Chevron and ExxonMobil in the U.S. and Shell in the U.K. have also reported record profits. Exxon booked income of almost $18 billion in the second quarter, more than three times what it earned in the same quarter last year. Revenue jumped almost $116 billion from $68 billion a year ago. Chevron's performance was disgusting, shall we say, with their profit more than tripling to $11.6 billion as sales spiked to $65 billion compared with $36 billion a year ago. Now look, Putin's war in Ukraine has limited oil and gas supply from Russia, and that's pushed up energy prices that were already skyrocketing, particularly as global demand recovered from the pandemic pits. Aramco says it expects oil demand to continue to grow through 2030, despite current pressures. Isabella Simonetti wrote last month that companies said they would expand production somewhat, but would also reward their shareholders with a big increase in share buyback programs. At the same time, weak economic data coming out of China yesterday sent oil prices down another 3% right away on demand concerns. That news confirmed worries that China's growth is continuing to slow, although Hope King reports that markets largely shrugged off the news by the end of trading. And, of course, the People's Bank of China surprisingly cut one of its key interest rates for the second time this year. That was only 0.1%, but economist Iris Pang of ING said the rate cut shows the entire economy is in trouble. Policymakers in China are facing a number of challenges that prevent them from feeling confident about economic growth this year. A slowdown in China, second largest economy, would ultimately have a ripple effect on the rest of the world. Of course, diplomatic unrest and growing conflict with the U.S. over Taiwan is only making worries worse. But as King points out, U.S. corporate earnings have been better than expected, and investors seem to be less sensitive to this year's series of bad economic and geopolitical news, although sentiment among U.S. consumers is way down. The prices at the pump continuing to fall. I noticed the price marquee at one of the gas stations where I lived changed 3 times yesterday. Well, it's likely that exorbitant profits could take a hit in the third quarter. Now, wouldn't it be nice to see big oil return some of their easily earned windfall profits to everyday Americans in the form of even lower prices? Yes, I dream, but perhaps a windfall profits tax dangling over their heads would provide adequate incentive. After all, too much of a good thing for those at the top just makes income inequality all the worse for the rest of us. That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back on Thursday with Melody. Butch will join her tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in. I'm Dave Allen. Have a good evening. Please be safe out there. Bye.
Broadcasting to the U.S. and around the world by way of Clear Digital Audio, 22,500 miles above the planet.